Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you today, Monday, September 30th, 2019. Nine South Sudanese men, including national security agents, are sentenced to prison.
First accused person, Private Arol Manuon Kwol Akwol, is dismissed from National Security Service active list, deprived from being paid due post-retirement pension.
And accessing South Sudan's government information is a citizen's right, but making it happen is a whole other thing.
Sometimes we need data on particular thing, and this data is kept somewhere by the government, and the government does not want us to get access to it.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A military court in Juba on Friday sentenced nine men to long prison terms, including members of the National Security Service and two police officers. All nine were convicted of armed robbery or other serious crimes. Demo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
It is so done.
29-year-old Army Private Arol Manuon Akwol, who served on the National Security Service, was found guilty of robbing motorists at gunpoint. Presiding Judge Major General Marshal Stephen Babanen sentenced Akwol to life in prison.
First accused person, Private Arol Manuon Kwol Akwol, is dismissed from National Security Service active list, deprived from being paid due post-retirement pension or any after-service gratuities, if any. The convicted person is sentenced to life imprisonment with effect from the date of his arrest as from 23rd October 2018, and thereof he shall be sent to civil prisons authority to serve his term of imprisonment.
Two police officers were also found guilty of armed robbery. The presiding judge sentenced Captain William Deng to 3 years in prison and a fine of 150,000 South Sudanese pounds, the equivalent of $600. Lieutenant Kwot Chol Chol was dismissed from the South Sudan National Police Service and sentenced to 3 years in prison. The suspects were charged according to Article 48, CGC 2, 300 and 305 of South Sudan's Penal Code 2008 and the 2013 National Security Act. Judge Babanen also sentenced six civilians, including one Egyptian and a Sudanese national, of up to 10 years in prison. The six were also ordered to pay hefty fines and return stolen vehicles to their owners. The convicted civilians include an engineer, a businessman, and an insurance broker. Defense lawyers called the sentences severe for the crimes committed. Speaking in Arabic, defense lawyer Santino Mao says civilians should not have been tried in a military court.
What surprised me is the presence of civilians in a military court, and they are being convicted, but we'll appeal that this case is tried in a civil court because you cannot try civilians in a military court.
Speaking in Arabic, defense lawyer Chair Rehan Chair says his client, Police Captain William Deng, is innocent of all charges.
He did not share in the robberies and was never caught in any act. He did not even get any share of the loots. So we are going to appeal to the High Court.
Deputy South Sudan National Police Service spokesman Colonel James Dark says the stiff sentences will act as deterrent to all police and national security officers who abuse their position.
This punishment is an example to organized forces that you will not run away from being punished. And it gives us that whatever you do, at the end of the day, you will be apprehended and you will be sentenced. For example, now, a police officer to be sentenced to life imprisonment or national security officer to be sentenced to long-term imprisonment is really a pity because
all of the suspects were arrested about a year ago. Juba residents have been complaining for months about the city's high crime rate, especially nighttime robberies. For VOA News, I am Demo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
South Sudanese reporters and researchers say they often face roadblocks from both government and private institutions when trying to access information about the country. Speaking on Universal Access to Information Day in Juba on Friday, a South Sudanese Information Ministry official said it's every citizen's right to access information. Winnie Serino has more for VOA from Juba.
Niall Tit-Mamer, a senior researcher at the Juba-based SUD Institute, says it is often difficult for researchers to obtain important information from the government, which affects the content of final reports.
Sometimes we actually don't deliver because of lack of data. Sometimes we need data on a particular thing, and this data is kept somewhere by the government, and the government does not want us to get access to it. And sometimes we would write letters to get the data, and sometimes the government will give us the permission, and sometimes the people who are the gatekeepers of the information may also frustrate. And so sometimes you end up not getting the information, not because the senior government official has not granted you the permission, but because somebody somewhere there does not want to do his or her job.
Tit-Mamer says under South Sudan's transitional constitution, citizens are allowed to access information held by government departments, but some government officials think all information is confidential.
Sometimes people don't differentiate between confidential information and an information that is supposed to be accessible to the public. Let's say, for example, how much, does, oil, a barrel of oil costs. This is a price. This is important. It's not secret, and it should be disclosed to the people. The other important information, too, example, is information about contracts. So who has been given the contract by the government is important. And the reason it is important is to actually deter any type of corruption and bribery and conflict of interest.
According to the Petroleum Act, if the government issues a contract, the tender must be public. Once an entity or individual has won the contract, the government must inform the public on the qualifications of the contractor, technical expertise, and the financial status. Tit-Mamer says institutions usually refuse to provide that information because they fear it may expose some illegal actions or negatively affect certain government officials. A journalist who prefers to be identified only as Christine for safety reasons says she tried to follow up a corruption story involving the Minister of Health, but no ministry official would agree to talk to her on record. She says she also wanted to publish a story about rape cases in Juba, but officials at the Gender Ministry denied her access to information.
I went to Ministry of Gender. I was looking for information about this, the statistics of rape cases. When I was doing a feature story about rape, then they told me the right person was not in the office, and the person I got there, who is supposed to give me the information, they said they can't, as they state me, the Minister of Gender, they can't release information and how to journalists.
South Sudan's Commissioner for Information, Nicodemus Ajak, admits several journalists have reported being denied access to information by public institutions, but says no journalist has complained to his commission officially. Ajak says the commission has launched a strategy to ease access to information.
One of the things that we need to be putting in place is the infrastructure itself, so that when you go to a public institution, you are able to get information. How then do you get it? This is what we are going to be working on.
Doreen Gune, Communications Officer at the United Nations Cultural Agency, UNESCO, represented UNESCO's Country Director in South Sudan at the Universal Access to Information Day event in Juba. Gune says the unprecedented digital transformation in the current era is leading to new forms of inequality, which he says must be dealt with.
To combat this, digital innovation must go hand in hand.
To combat this, digital innovation must go hand in hand with the obligation of member states to adopt and improve legislation for public access to information through implementing laws, investing in relevant infrastructure, and engaging civil society and young people in particular. Access to information can protect human rights and drive sustainable development.
Universal Access to Information Day is celebrated every year on September 28th. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
South Sudanese education officials used theater to promote peaceful coexistence among young people during South Sudan's fifth annual theater festival. The four-day event under the theme Reconciliation and Peaceful Coexistence wrapped up on Friday, as we hear from Lasuba Memo for VOA in Juba.
Hundreds of students from 13 different secondary schools in and around Juba attended the production that included theater performances, storytelling, and stand-up comedians who addressed the not-so-funny issues of cattle wrestling, land grabbing, and intercommunal violence. Sixteen-year-old James Kenneth of Superior Secondary School spoke in Arabic in a play entitled Money Isn't Everything in Marriage. It is about a man who is about to marry a young woman named Nyoka, but his uncles are unable to pay the dowry demanded by Nyoka's parents, so the parents refuse their daughter's hand in marriage. James threatens to commit suicide if he cannot marry Nyoka, the girl of his dreams. The two families later resolve the matter amicably through a third party. James says the play delivers an important message to young people.
It's not just a matter of acting, but it's a matter of giving message for the people to take it and work with it outside in the country as at large. It will bring back the country in the extent that we are South Sudanese, we may have that heart and that love for each other.
Unfortunately, James says South Sudan lacks good leaders, but he says the South Sudanese people have the ability to change their future with or without good leaders.
If we as the grassroots work with this, we can change our beloved country. But we lack good leadership in this country. For us to have a good leadership, we have to follow this issue of dramas and so forth, so that we can change our minds and we can change our country.
In the same way, 18-year-old Nelson Kwal plays the mediator who helps resolve the dispute between James and Yoka's families.
I think when we practice something good, in the future will be good. When we practice something bad, also we continue like this. No, but we want something good that will help our future. Among us, when we practice something good, also our leaders will change.
26-year-old Marlene James is a drama teacher at the Ilmi Secondary School. James says most young South Sudanese are advocates for peace.
Some of them are talking about peace. Some of them are talking about reconciliation. Some of them are talking about the fighting that we are doing here. Some of them are looking for the solution for the country. And us, all of us, we know that we are still looking for peace. So that is the message that those people sent yesterday, that peace is with us. Peace is with us, young people.
Dominique Garguri, chairperson of the South Sudan Theatre Organizing Committee, says the festival aims to demonstrate that peace is achieved through dialogue, as evidenced by the signing of the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement. But Garguri admits the peace deal continues to face a lot of challenges.
Not only just signing the papers and moving from here to there, and, you know, the violations of peace himself is a problem. And not only the politicians who are the one, not even issues related to peace, but if we give the young generation the chance, I think you see how the students, and they are from different tribes, they doesn't even care about from where they are. But they are in the one place, they are practicing one thing, they are focusing on what South Sudan is, so this is what we need.
Dominic is urging South Sudanese leaders to focus on the young generation and to include them in all aspects of implementing the peace agreement. Jubek State Education Minister Wanim Suleiman says government officials are listening to today's youth.
We take their concerns seriously as leaders. We take our concerns seriously because they are going to be the future leaders. So if you don't take it seriously, we'll be accountable for this.
When he says last week's theater performances will enhance the country's national dialogue process, he says has not always incorporated the views of young people in the past. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Sudanese citizens file a criminal complaint against a well-known bank. Find out why when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
have you ever had to deal with a bully? What did you do?
When I was in lower primary, we had pupils who were bullies. They would offend you or try to attack you or provoke you or mock you. For personally, I ignored the bully. I just ignore them and they will stop.
I do just ignore. I see them as if they have not done anything to me. I've never responded to what they do. And sometimes you might look at it as if the person is just trying to talk to him or herself. That's how I've ever dealt with bullying in school.
Just ignore it. Ignore that person. That person's so rash on you. You just take it easy. And yeah, just like that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Busy work schedule of some immigrant parents in Canada has affected their children's performance in school. Lily Edward Mario of Kitchener, Canada, has dedicated her time to helping South Sudanese children with their school workloads.
The program started in 2012. It was started by the South Sudanese community leader. It was initially designed for the high school students who were struggling and leaving high school.
Why would people leave high school, or why would people struggle with high school? I thought when you go to high school, you must have successfully completed your elementary education. Why should people struggle?
I think language barriers and even the education system here is a lot different than African. In high school, there are a lot of struggle. And if English is a second language and you don't understand and you don't know how to relate or communicate with the teachers here, then you will feel that high school is not for you, or school is not for you in general. I don't know, everybody's struggle is different, but definitely I would say language barriers was the main reason kids or the youth just didn't feel like being in the school.
How was your story? How was your struggle?
My struggle personally is the language, and I think coming from Africa, I had like a heavy accent, and actually I experienced bullying in the school too because of that. But that didn't discourage me because I already know my goal. I know that I came to Canada. Canada is a host country for me, but I have a home. I knew who I am, where I came from. So that helped me to just accept who I am and just kind of embrace that I'm different. I'm not at that time a Canadian. Well, now I'm a Canadian citizen, but my background is Sudanese, and that's my identity, right? And I think for other students, the story is different too. I don't know why they chose not to pursue higher education, why they decided to leave high school. Maybe they're not understanding their teachers. Maybe the work was too much for them. I don't really know their stories, but we saw that a lot, and even some of them were involved in gang. I know when I came here in 2004, there were a lot of gang activities among the South Sudanese youth.
You came here at the age of 13.
At 13, yeah.
And young people at your age continue facing difficulties in school because
yes.
of culture, language.
Exactly. Culture was one of them, but I think mostly language too, just not able to connect with the teachers and peers and experiencing bullying from teachers. Discouragement from teachers was a huge thing in high school. Even I experienced it too. They always want you to do something that you're not interested in. They will force you to sports or maybe just take some courses that will lead you to trades instead of, you know, pursuing a professional job. That's another reason why in high school, particularly where we went to, there were a lot of South Sudanese kids, and all of them had the same complaint that they didn't receive support from their guidance counselors or from their teachers, always discouraging them, or their teachers favoring particular group of children and kind of neglecting them, not supporting them. We experienced that a lot, you know.
So with this experience in high school, it led to some students dropping off.
Yes.
And your program is taking care of students who dropped out of high school. What do you do for these students?
Okay, so the program, it was for these students who were high school dropouts or school dropouts in general. But now I work with younger kids. I work with elementary elementary students from grade 1 to 6. These are the kids I'm supporting right now. So what we do with them, we help them with their assignments, homework, and even we had a math teacher that will help them with mathematics. And just kind of be a supportive or social environment for the kids to feel comfortable with the South Sudanese kids, even to like socialize with them and make friends, and just to know that there are people in the community who are ready to support them and just be there for them when they need the help.
And how many kids are you taking care of?
Right now we have 35 students and four volunteers.
That's Lily Edward Mario, a young South Sudanese who helps children in their community with their homework. She was speaking with my colleague John Tanza in Kitchener, Waterloo, Canada. Tomorrow, Mario talks about some of the other problems facing South Sudanese children in Canadian schools. Sudanese victims of war crimes filed a criminal complaint against French bank BNP Paribas for alleged complicity in a slew of human rights abuses committed by Sudan's previous regime. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more from Paris on the case supported by U.S. and French rights groups.
This is not the first time BNP Paribas has been targeted over its dealings with Sudan. In 2015, a U.S. judge sentenced the bank to 5 years of probation and nearly $9 billion after it pleaded guilty to violating United States sanctions against not only Sudan, but also Iran and Cuba. This case is different. Rights activists say it's the first effort to hold the bank criminally responsible for alleged complicity in crimes against humanity, genocide, and torture in Sudan between 2002 and 2008. It says BNP was essentially acting as the de facto central bank for the regime of former President Omar al-Bashir during that period by allowing it access to financial markets.
These crimes do not occur in a vacuum with no funds.
Cynthia Tai is executive director of U.S.-based nonprofit Project Expedite Justice, one of the rights groups supporting the Sudanese victims in the case.
They occur because people can buy weapons, because people can buy trucks, because people can buy the tools that they need to commit these grave violations.
The International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants against Bashir on war crimes and genocide charges in Sudan's Darfur region, but has been unable to prosecute him in The Hague. The ousted leader is on trial in his home country on corruption charges.
We can take him to the court, and I think that will be the first step.
Abdel Halim Hassan is one of the Sudanese filing the complaint. He says the government-backed Janjaweed militia attacked his village in Darfur numerous times, killing people, including his relatives. Later, as a student rights activist, he says he was imprisoned and tortured. He now lives in the United States.
My journey to the justice is going to be long, not only the bank, but to bring the real criminals to the court.
BNP could not be reached for comment Thursday afternoon, but a spokesperson told AFP news agency it was not aware a criminal probe had been opened and did not comment on judicial processes. This is not the first effort to hold French businesses responsible for rights abuses committed overseas. Authorities here are looking into whether Lafarge cement manufacturer paid the Islamic State group to keep its factories running in areas it controlled in Syria. Anjali Suwali is a lawyer for the Paris-based International Federation for Human Rights, which is also supporting the Sudanese victims.
We hope that by taking a step that we have today, we've put these companies on notice that they need to be aware that these types of business deals are risky.
French investigating magistrates must now determine whether the Sudanese complaint is admissible and whether to open an investigation. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The South Sudanese under 20 football team was eliminated on Sunday from the Council for East and Central Africa Football Associations, or SACAFA as it's known. It was the first time in history that the sport of the South Sudanese team progressed to the quarterfinals of an international competition. Officials and players say reaching the quarterfinals shows the sport is developing in the country. Megumi Davis Rakarunj has this report for VOA from Kampala, Uganda.
The South Sudan under 20 football team lost 1-0 against a well polished Sudan team in a quarterfinal match played in the northern Uganda town of Gulu yesterday. Despite the outcome, the South Sudanese players remain optimistic. South Sudan coach Simon James blames inexperience playing at the quarterfinal level for the team's loss.
Most of them now come from the small teams and don't have experience. That is the problem with my team. But if you are playing more games or more entertainment, you can get the experience. And you cannot get the experience in the team. You can get the experience in the international games.
James says there are no football academies in South Sudan, and local clubs do not have junior teams to develop local talent. Speaking in Arabic, team captain Daniel Samuel says he learned a lot in the SACAFA tournament.
Although I played in one of the big teams in Konyokonyo in Juba, it is here that I have actually learned a lot. When I return home, I will try to help my team a lot using the experience that I have got here. And when I play for the national team, I can play with a lot of confidence.
The 18-year-old left-back plays for local team Erimriek Football Club. Samuel also dreams of playing for bigger clubs, especially in Europe. 19-year-old Bai Lam Chan, who plays for the local club at Tarabara, says before long his team will make it routine to win football matches for South Sudan.
It's our first time to make one step going to quarterfinal. We have been participating senior team, under 17, under 20, but we have never qualified for quarterfinal. We are very happy. And we also want to make our country happy.
En route to the quarterfinals, South Sudan drew 3-3 against Burundi and won 3-0 against Somalia, scoring 6 goals in the campaign. In other quarterfinal games, host Uganda were beaten 4-2 by Tanzania. Kenya defeated Burundi 2-1, while Zanzibar was thrashed 5-0 by Eritrea. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
That is our show for this Monday. We now leave you with a song, Makoli, by Makumba. You've been listening to Makumba with the song Makoli. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.